Well, all right. It's my favorite time of the week. Glad you could join us here on the Bite Me Fishing Show. Happy Sunday with Captain Scott Null, Captain Caleb McCumber, and Captain Dean Thomas. I'm John Lopez. And, you know, I always get excited about this show because it's always fun and entertaining. Today, I feel as if it's important, too. So much to talk about, and there's been so much talk about desalination plants, what to do, a lot of anxiousness out there. We're going to be joined by Shane Bonneau, the Advocacy Director for CCA Texas, to really dig in deep on all of it. But I wanted to get the guys' thoughts on this because it's made so many headlines. Caleb?
One thing I did see this week that, you know, where I've been, what I've been seeing, is this asinine information on pumping brackish water into Baffin Bay. Is that a topic today? That should be a topic today.
It should be.
They're having meetings. They're having all kinds of crap about it. And when some jackass sitting at a table in some boardroom somewhere is telling us we're going to make this water and we're going to save Baffin Bay, like it's pitchfork and axes and torches time. And I'm like, no, spend the extra money, pump it back in the ground. If you have to run a pipeline way out in the Gulf or something, but pumping that much water into Alazan Bay daily to save the bay, kiss my ass. That's one of the most consistent bays on the coast. You know, it may not, there may be times whenever it's not super awesome, but mm-hmm. It never gets super bad there, you know, outside of a brown tide or something.
Look, but, I'm glad you brought it up. I thought of it myself. Dean, I know you got some thoughts on this because you've been fighting that fight right there.
Yeah, and I saw some of the comments that came from the so-called scientific side of where that it was actually going to improve Baffin Bay, that it was going to that it was dead, that Baffin Bay was struggling and this was going to benefit them. I mean, they will try to spin that crap into any way they can. And good luck with the piping offshore. The desal plant that has been in conversation here in Corpus Christi, that the battles, the legal battles that have to be fought they're insurmountable because the companies, the industry can out-lawyer the conservation groups. It's just the way it is. I've watched that take place with people that wholeheartedly fight this thing. But when it comes down to it, to fight a multi-billion dollar industry with lawyers is very, very difficult. And yes, everybody agrees the pipeline should be offshore. The discharge should be out there. The intake should be out there. But the legal battles are endless. And and hopefully, I mean, this one is kind of just getting started. I don't know if it's actually been permitted. Has permits been approved? Did they apply for permits? I mean, there is a lot to the process. And hopefully there will be enough public outcry to make them think. But I mean, the battles never end. We sit here, we talk about fishing and the issues that face it. The industrial water quality issues, without a doubt, are the number one threat to the quality of our bays. Hey, man, look at Corpus Christi Ship Channel. They dredged that thing to 100 feet deep, 180 feet wide. As soon as it was finished being dredged, they applied for permits to make it deeper and wider. And I watched every day what the water quality turned into. Every day, the tankers go by and they roll wakes all of the way to Ransom Island from the Ship Channel. I mean, they crash. They're 3-foot rollers that go all the way across the bay. I've watched the seagrass deteriorate. Ransom and Dagger Flats, two of the most beautiful flats, amazing crystal clear water 20 years ago, are going to be dead in my lifetime. I mean, you can plainly look at Dagger Flats. Dagger is the closest to Ingleside down at the end, and it is almost a sand flat now. What used to be the lushest, because it's deeper, so even on the lowest tide, it never went dry. The grass always was covered with water. Beautiful, amazing turtle grass, and it's just about gone now. And that stuff, the one thing that is proven is that it doesn't grow back. It is a very slow process. Whenever it is gone, it's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so how the salinity, I mean, that's... Yeah, how is that going to affect the ecosystem in Baffin Bay? And you know, Here's the other question. What's really in that water that's discharging? How many gallons a day are they really going to pump into that bay? Mm-hmm. So, and they're willing to absorb the fines. They break the rules all the time. And then they just pay the fine because the money they're making outweighs the fine by multitudes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's repeated. And they're putting one, a discharge into Copano Bay from.
Like Dean said, at the end of the day, this is all about making money. The cheapest thing, and you know, I'm paraphrasing Chad Pederick here. The cheapest thing is to just go dump it into Baffin and say, "Oh, don't worry, guys, we're rescuing the sea turtles. They don't like being so salty."
Yeah.
And instead of, you know, pumping them back in the ground, it costs a hell of a lot more money. And I'm not a
earth or offshore into the ground or offshore.
Yeah. Or
yeah. Not to mention the fact that that bay has existed for thousands and thousands of years before we decided to start pumping shit into it. Yeah. And now, we're going to save it.
Yeah.
By pumping some shit that never, it's ludicrous. The excuses and stories that they come up with to justify what they're going to do.
We're from the government and we're here to help.
Yeah.
You know, I was there last week and I was thinking to myself, some bitch, you know what we could use? About 1.5 million gallons of fresh water, because up there in Matagorda, we didn't quite get enough. And that's not why I'm down here right now.
I mean, a
rainstorm sucks and they want to do it daily. But like Dean said, this is money, greasing money. And I see comments on here. It's not Chad's post, but just it's all over my Facebook just because of who all I'm friends with. Mm-hmm. But they can't fight, like Dean said, billion-dollar companies, particularly with politicians that got hands in their pockets that are backing these companies. You know, somebody on that board fishes. Somebody on that board's fished Bassman Bay before.
But the other thing is, Dean talked about the attorneys, and you mentioned it as well, Caleb. But the public outcry has helped in the Aransas area, Dean. It has helped. It did stem it off a little bit.
It not really. I mean, the things that are taking place were always planned. It hasn't changed the motivation and the outcome of what we're going to end up with.
You think it just delayed it?
So when they wanted to put it in at Harbor Island, I forget what the actual, it wasn't resistance. I don't remember what the reason was, but for them to change their plans and move it to the inner harbor in the port of Corpus Christi, mm-hmm. which of course that's even a shorter pipeline. So I'm sure that saves them a lot of money, but any body of water that is connected to Corpus Christi Bay is connected to the Laguna Madre. It is connected to Redfish Bay, Aransas mm-hmm. Bay. I mean, you can see every one of those things from there. I mean, they are less than 10 miles in any direction. And for to suck up hundreds of millions of gallons of water per day, discharged what's left over in a concentrated brine, it's going to affect the ecosystem. And what comes out, and we may have talked about this in the past. So what comes out is the brine. It's the same. So the salt, from the people that I've talked to, the salt that they're putting back into the bay is not a problem because that was already there. So they're just mm-hmm. taking something out and putting it out. The detrimental part is the water that goes in to the intake is full of larvae and every little tiny sea creature from plankton to everything that swims, and it comes out sterile. Nothing swims in one end and swims out the other end. It is gone. So the biggest issue is the amount of creatures that go in and don't come out the other side.
Yeah.
The salt that comes out was salt that was already in the bay. It comes out in a concentrated form. And from what I understand, it disperses. And that is not the worst part of it. But what the intake takes in is the worst part of it.
And that's what ultimately sends fish away. Kills fish, doesn't have
it kills them and they don't ever get a chance to grow up and replenish the stocks.
And Baffin Bay, Caleb, you were just there, kind of landlocked, you know. There's nowhere else for it to go.
No, it's just, I mean, you're not even getting tides in and out of jetties or anything. It's a Baffin Bay is a great big ass saltwater pond that's got an inlet and outlet on each end of it. It's it's rather defenseless, to be honest. And so I don't understand. You know, I've said it before. It's been years since I've had to say this on the show, but it's our job as men to just screw things up. Like that's what we do. We tear up everything.
Let's get more on what Dean has been hearing. Then we'll bring in a guy who's seen all the research, all the plans next here on Sports Radio 610. Welcome back. So we've heard a lot of stuff about what these desal plants will do. I want to get to Dean, but we've heard all kinds of different things.
You know, I'm not going to sit here and act like I'm an expert on a desal plant and all that, but don't blow sunshine up trying to tell me that you're here to save Baffin Bay by doing this. This has nothing to do with Baffin Bay. Baffin Bay doesn't need saving. Maybe the people in Corpus need some water to drink. Hey, you know what? Dean's going to die of thirst in the next 6 months if we don't do this, and it sucks, but we have to dump some into Baffin Bay. I can accept that. I can accept it. Like, okay, all right, well, you know, but tough times, damn it. But don't sit there and, oh, we're here to save it and help it. No.
So here's one more fun fact when it comes to water usage in Corpus Christi. Corpus Christi has refineries. It has chemical plants. The chemical plants and all of that uses 70% of the water. 30% of the water goes to residents and to the people. I've had this conversation, and that came from the San Patricio County Water Commissioner, came to one of our Rotary meetings and did the presentation. He showed where how much water comes from the Mary Rose pipeline, how much comes from Choke Canyon, how much comes from Lake Corpus Christi, and so on and so forth. Then he showed how much everybody used. At that point, we're on level 3 water restrictions. The people in that, you can't water your yard, you can't wash your car. When I asked him, okay, the people who use a smaller fraction of the water than the industry are forced to abide by these rules. I said, what does industry do to conserve water? I said, what restrictions are put on industry? There was a lady in the crowd that worked at one of those companies, and she turned around me. She was completely offended. What are we going to do? Stop industry? I mean, she was offended. And I'm like, apparently you need to. So with this desal plant that is going to disrupt the ecosystem is going to feed the industry. It is not going to give Dean and Caleb and John a fresh glass of water to drink. Yeah. It is not the driving force of why that it is being built. It is so they can continue to build chemical plants, not refineries, but what's growing in Gregory and Portland are chemical plants where they create plastics, or they create the chemicals that create plastic. That is what is going on. And the reason that is happening in Corpus Christi is because they have these vast, giant cotton fields and corn fields that are owned by one giant corporate farm. So when it comes time to build a plant like that, they go to one person and they can buy giant mega swath of land in one land deal. There's other deals that where people are holding out for their land, they're holding out, they're fighting. They make these giant mega plots difficult to purchase. South Texas has energy. We have natural gas that flows out of the ground. We have transportation, which is water and rail, and we have available space. That combination is what is causing this to grow, causing the need for more water, creating a desalination plant.
Yeah. See, I can get on board. I can get on board with the industry, though. It provides jobs to a bunch of people. It drives the economy.
Hold up.
We're circling right back to blowing sunshine up.
So here's another thing about the jobs and such. That is kind of, those numbers get twisted. When they construct them, when the thing is being built, yes, they do have a ton of workers. But when they're in operation for perpetuity, there are minimal staff at those places. It is nothing like, but they will tell you, they will throw that number of how many jobs.
All these jobs, yeah.
Construction
is temporary.
But you're talking about a desal plant.
No, well, when it comes to building like Exxon, they built the Exxon plant in Gregory. Whenever that was built, of course, there's an army of construction workers in there, iron workers, electricians, all this. And they will tell you, well, when we created 10,000 jobs, well, it takes them 2 to 3 years to build it. In 2 to 3 years, all of those jobs are gone. Then they have people in there, gaugers, monitors, scientists and such, which is a very small number compared
right.
to that number that they throw at you in the beginning that makes everybody say, whoa, mm-hmm. whoa, everybody's going to have these jobs.
And but I guess
your jobs, the perpetuity is the people that work there. The construction is very temporary.
I guess you have a point there in that, you know, if we don't have the water to support the facility, go build a facility in Beeville or something, like quit stacking them up right here and needing more mm-hmm. and more here. Mm-hmm. But I got that if that's the point you're making, I'll ride with that one for sure.
Mm-hmm. But it's connected to the port, which where they can bring ships. It's the transportation factor that goes along with energy, space, and transportation.
Well, they'll build one by Noel's house in Port O'Connor. There ain't one there yet. They got all kinds of water.
Yeah, that'll go over well. He'll have a skid steer out.
Up the road from there in Port Lavaca, they have the Formosa Superfund site, which there's a line across that bridge. And above that, you should never eat any fish out of that water. There are warnings that say, do not eat a fish that comes from this bay. And if that's not a lesson learned.
That's exactly right.
I mean, maybe 7C should go rescue that bay.
Well, that's a perfect place to bring in Shane Bonneau right there. I mean, so many of our listeners and friends of our listeners are going to want to hear this. Desalination plants and the water crisis down south, especially the coastal bend. Let's talk about it with Shane Bonneau, Advocacy Director for the CCA Texas. Next. Hey there. Welcome back to the Bite Me Fishing Show on Sports Radio 610. I'm John Lopez, and you're going to want to hear all about this. Text your friends down in the coastal bend area as well. All right, so a lot of discussion here on the podcast and the Bite Me Radio Fishing and Outdoors show here on Oyster Buyback Program that happened last year. There's some updates on that we'll get to, and a lot of discussion. Boy, if you want to get salty on Facebook, just mention the two words, desal plant, and things will start happening on there. So a lot to cover. We have Shane Bonneau, who is the advocacy director. Is that still your title? Or are you getting
another
promotion?
No, that's it.
you probably deserve another promotion. But
thank you.
Shane Bonneau, advocacy director for CCA Texas, joins us. So I figured let's just get right to the people that are kind of front lines on this, Shane. And I'm not going to bury the lead. I honestly know enough to be dangerous on the desalination plants and just how important right now it is to get some kind of answer on the water shortages on especially down in the coastal bend. But it's such a hot button issue, so I'm gonna just kind of plead ignorance here because mm-hmm. I don't want to sound like a Facebook post and say, well, they're gonna do this and they're gonna do that and this is going to be the start of something horrible or you're reading too much into it. Give us to start here, just a thumbnail sketch, if you will, on what is going on. And then we'll get into, you know, some of the particulars.
Sure. Well, this definitely is a salty conversation
or it really is a
briny conversation.
Yes. I see what you're doing there.
Yeah. Yeah. First of all, let's start with what is desalination, right? And there's two ways you could go about it. Two ways that is being explored here in Texas. And the first one is groundwater, brackish water desal. So pumping up slightly salty water from underground, very deep aquifers we have along the Texas coast. Sit well below all of our freshwater aquifers
mm-hmm.
and pump that water up and you run it through a reverse osmosis, a desal facility, remove all of the salts and you end up with fresh water. Those salts are returned what we advocate for is to put those salts back down into a well, mm-hmm. a salt dome or some other containment system underground. But there are some that are in production now that release and go into our bay systems.
Mm-hmm.
The other desalination process is taking ocean or bay surface water. So pumping seawater from the Texas coast, pumping it through a facility, removing the salts, And that's much saltier water. It's taking the ambient salinities from our bay systems, removing the salts, and returning the brine, the salt slurry, back into hopefully offshore waters. That's one thing that CCA Texas has advocated for any desal facility. If they're pumping it up out of the ground, we want it going back, the discharge going back into the ground. Mm-hmm. If they're pumping it from a bay system or from offshore, we want that discharge going back offshore. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of concerns from conservationists, anglers, people that live on the coast about the impacts of multiple desalination facilities releasing the brine discharge into a bay system and what that could do with effects on certainly salinity, but also it could have some dissolved oxygen effects. It could have some habitat effects and of course, effects on all the things that we care about, mm-hmm. Fish larvae, crab larvae, shrimp larvae, things like that.
So let's go there then, yeah, because that is the hot button issue is where they're releasing it, no matter which kind of desal plant you're talking about. You've seen the research, I'm sure some anyway, if not a lot. What is the research telling you about some of the things that can, you know, specifically happen if it's released into bay systems?
Yeah, and the answer to this question is going to be variable depending upon the amount that's released in the bay system that they're mm-hmm. proposing to release it in and the area, the specific discharge location, because so many things influence where that brine goes, how quickly it's exchanged in our bay system. Mm-hmm. And so the impacts can vary wildly, but for some of the projects that are gaining the most steam, let's take Corpus Christi Inner Harbor, mm-hmm. for example. They've done a lot of modeling on that one, several modeling runs, both really close to the discharge, but then also far field modeling across the entire bay system. Mm-hmm. And they see, you know, minimal impacts to salinity is what their modeling shows. However, the release of the brine into the bay system may only raise the bay salinity by half a part per thousand or one part per thousand. But by doing that, you are increasing that bay's average salinity. So you get one permit in Inner Harbor, then they permit one in the La Quinta Channel, and then they want to put in another one somewhere closer to Port Aransas near Ingleside. It's like you start to have this death by a thousand cuts, and now mm-hmm. you haven't increased the base salinity by half a part or one part per thousand. You've increased it by three or four parts per thousand with multiple desal facilities in the same area. So everybody realizes we need desal. It's not the answer. It's just a tool. It's one tool that you can mm-hmm. use to get fresh water to the coast. But these facilities need to be located in spots where you can have the intake and discharge offshore, and you have the property and the real estate available to scale these things up to meet future demands along the Texas coast. And specifically that one in Corpus in the Inner Harbor, it's a 30 million gallon per day plant, so that's proposed, and it'll meet some short-term needs for the city of Corpus Christi, but it's not going to meet the 50-year needs mm-hmm. for the city. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be thinking 50 years and beyond for these facilities and put them in locations, again, where they can intake and discharge offshore and ramp them up as those needs increase.
And as there's discharge, the water the intake is not just pure salt water. There are larvae and small animals and shrimp and things like that. So you're actually directly impacting the habitat and the ecosystem, correct?
Absolutely. You get impingement and entrapment with anything that's smaller than or larger, you know, anything that can't withstand the velocity of that intake structure. Mm-hmm. They'll get impinged on the screen, or they'll actually enter into the system and get entrapped in the process of the desalination facility. And so, yeah, that's a major concern. You certainly don't want to site these things in a spot where you have a lot of larval exchange or where you have mm-hmm. heavy spawning activity. And so, municipalities and private corporations that are looking into desal need to take those into consideration as well. And so when we advocate for an offshore intake, that's one of the things you have to be wary of, is making sure that intake is far enough offshore so that you're not sucking up a bunch of redfish larvae in the process.
Now, what's the counter argument that you're hearing from these plants that or proposed plants?
Well, it's always location and cost. Mm-hmm. For a city like Corpus, they can't site a project on real estate that they don't own. At least that was the argument that we'd heard over and over again. So they had to site a project on property that they owned, and that restricted some of their locations. And then when you talk about piping, 2 to 3 miles offshore, there's extreme cost to that. But ultimately, we need to consider the cost of not doing something like that, the cost mm-hmm. to the health of the bay systems, and just the coastal economy that depends on a healthy fisheries.
Has there been any? Well, I'm sure there has, but have you seen any research on that cost, on the cost to the fishery itself, on what you and I like to do?
I haven't seen anything specific that because there's so many unknowns in there, and so much is modeled. It's not actual hard data because we don't have a large facility in operation yet, one of mm-hmm. our base systems. So I think research like that will be interesting to see, especially if Inner Harbor and Corpus gets approved. There certainly needs to be a pre-construction analysis done mm-hmm. on the ecology of the bay, a biological assessment, and then a post startup date analysis. But I haven't seen anything specific on what the cost of 5 or 6 of these things would do to our
coast. That's the thing. Like a fisherman like myself, the way I put it is, I don't want to be the guinea pig. Right. I don't want to be the guinea pig. Our Gulf Coast, what we do, what you do, advocating for our bay system. I don't want to be the guinea pig, but at the same time, none of us are saying that there's not an incredible need for fresh water. I mean, we are running out of water. Let's talk about it next, right here on the Bite Me Fishing Show. We are back talking desal plants and more with Shane Bonneau, Advocacy Director for CCA Texas. What are you seeing and hearing right now, Shane?
It's promising to see some of the more recent ones that have been proposed for down south, for mm-hmm. Corpus, and then down on South Padre Island. The more recent ones are proposing offshore intake and discharge. So I mm-hmm. think some of the private companies that are trying to stand these up are listening to what the public is saying. And I feel they think that they could have a fast track on getting something approved because they'll have so much public support rather than opposition, as we're seeing with all these other projects.
Well, you talked about the public. Before we move on to the next topic I want to talk to you about, what can we do? Like, legitimately, what can we do?
Well, always... When you get word of a permit being considered by TCEQ, take the opportunity to one, ask for a public meeting. Mm-hmm. This is very important. Not a public hearing. You have to say public meeting.
Okay.
And that usually generates a lot of public interest and get people to show up and provide comments, advocating for whatever position you may have on the issue. That's the biggest thing anybody can do. And then, of course, contacting their legislatures, letting them know they don't want something in their bay system and that they want something offshore. The more we can just keep repeating that message to those officials that are making these decisions, I think the better off we're going to be. And it's starting to have some effect. We're seeing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you just real quick, because we can go on this, but I do want to move on to the next topic and we'll have you back on. What have our political leaders, where are they standing right now?
Well, they're most of them are doing their jobs as political leaders and sort of riding the fence.
Say no more.
There've been some bills that have been attempted to be filed that basically say you have to do this offshore. Mm-hmm. We may see a similar effort like that this next session, but until something like that's in play, I think we'll see most politicians just sort of ride the line and stay as far out of this conversation as they can. But again, coming back to us, the more pressure that we can put on them to do what we know is right for the bay systems, I think the better off we'll be.
Yeah. All right. Let's get to something of a more positive vibe, so to speak. So we've been talking about the buyback program. I know it was a topic a couple of times on this show over the last year, but there are some updates here. The Oyster Buyback Program, by the way, one of my proudest possessions I was able to be the high bidder on an oyster buyback license at the Redfish Bay CCA meeting, and I was just beaming. I was so glad. It's in a great spot right in my little place down in Aransas Pass. So, you know, we all support that. But there is updates. Give us the updates on the buyback.
Yeah, well, very cool. You got one of those pieces. You sent me that picture. And cool.
Oh, that's
art.
What I did.
Yeah, that was really cool art done by Sam Caldwell, and did a little commemorative. You got a little piece of history there, so that's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the buyback program, there have been 8 rounds of buyback that really didn't have any success. But then in 2025, Parks and Wildlife sort of shifted gears, and they took private money and matched it with some of the dollars that they had. So we had donations from CCA Texas, $1 million, some matching donation from Lori Morian and the Reed Morian Foundation. Reed was the chairman of the Parks and Wildlife Commission for a long time. Unfortunately, he passed away, but his foundation gave $1 million to this effort. And then there were multiple other donations from private individuals. So we had two pools of money. We had private money and public money. Those combined for a $30,000 flat rate offer. And so in 2025, flat rate offers went out to all commercial license holders, and they were able to buy back 112 of the 545 licenses that are out there in the market. So that took place in last year in 2025. And here just a few weeks ago, the next round closed. So the 2025 round was the 9th round. We just did the 10th round earlier this year, which just closed. And that one brought in an additional 46 licenses. So between those two rounds with the 30,000 flat rate offer, we've bought 158 of those 545 licenses, which is 30% of the fishery is now, you know, that potential pressure on our oyster reefs is now gone forever.
Yeah, and you said something key there, because I have heard some people saying, well, a lot of those licenses were dormant or whatever, or not being used in the family, but not all of them. And secondly, they will not be in circulation. There will be no additional. So,
right.
Are you seeing that an actual impact now?
Yeah, yes. Well, and even back to the last successful round in 2025, Parks and Wildlife did some analysis, and a substantial number, and I off the top of my head, it's like 40 to 50%, I think. Don't hold me to that. But it was a substantial number of those were active in the fishery at some point in time in the last 5 years. So,
oh, good.
The fishery changes year to year, depending on markets on the East Coast. And so, again, it's not so much about was that license fishing last year or not. It's more about the potential of those licenses to impact the coast. So if the market ever shifts completely back to Texas, then we've done ourselves a lot of good here with that 30% reduction.
That's awesome. And you're not, I'm guessing you said the 10th most recent, you're not done yet. And so, you know, back to the question of what can we do? What are people, you know, how can people help here?
Yeah. So several ways. One, that they can make donations to the Parks and Wildlife Foundation, who's spearheading this effort. That's the official non-partner of Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. So the foundation, Parks and Wildlife Foundation, can accept donations, and they'll stay in this pool of buyback funds. Additionally, they can support organizations that are contributing to buyback. So CCA Texas is one of those. So when a next round is proposed, I think we'll have to go to the state for appropriations to Parks and Wildlife to get some more of that public money. But when Parks and Wildlife has enough public money to do another round, I'm sure they'll come to CCA, they'll come to the foundation and private donors asking for some matching funds. And that's another opportunity to help out. So those are two good options.
Okay. I'm going to be a little ignorant here. Those licenses in-state and out-of-state, because that's always a big topic, or no?
Well, license could be transferred in-state and out-of-state year to year. I'm not sure if some of the ones that participated in buyback were out of state, or if these were all in state. Again, it really doesn't matter, because you could transfer a license at any point in time. And a lot of those out of state licenses are held by Texas fishermen that have leases in Louisiana, and they move from Louisiana and Texas and fish back and forth.
And what about on water impact? Are you seeing you know, between the buyback program, are you seeing maybe it's not getting as ravaged as it has in the past?
Yeah, I think some of it, you're noticing a little difference because of buyback. And most of the difference you're noticing are just a lot of changes in the dynamics of the oyster fishery itself. You have oyster farming, off-bottom cage growing of oysters taking place in Texas. And then we have this massive expansion of on-bottom oyster leases that is about to gain.
Just going
to
ask you about that. Let's go there. Yeah.
So Parks and Wildlife opened up this opportunity for commercial oystermen to self-identify areas where they wanted an on-bottom certificate of location or a lease. And so that application period was opened last fall, and the department received numerous, over 150 applications for over 9,000 acres of bay bottom across the coast. So your big bays, Galveston, Matagorda, San Antonio, Aransas. And they're in the process of working with those applicants and letting them know who got what. But we'll see a massive expansion of that program as those applicants go, you know, finalize their permitting process. This is going to take several years to get through, not only get through permitting, but get past permitting and actually start deploying material that can recruit oyster spat, oyster larvae. But again, the oyster fishery is seeing the shift from relying on 80% of the landings coming from public. They're seeing the shift going to more of this private model, either through oyster farms or through oyster leases. And so, that those two things are have made an impact on how the fishery is prosecuted.
And the leases are, I mean, what an awesome thing. And the way I always try to simplify things in my mind, you know, just to tell people, the way I describe it is it's my garden. You know, I'm not picking your tomatoes. You know, it's my garden. So, yes, I'm going to get those oysters. And correct me if I'm wrong or elaborate. I'm going to pick those oysters. I'm going to get them and drag there. But I'm also taking care of it because they're mine.
You're not going to over harvest it. You're not, you know, no one else is allowed to harvest those. You have exclusive harvest rights. You're actually going to cultivate it. You're going to be raking those oysters, turning them over, you know, prior to harvest or prior to an opportunity when you want spat to catch on them. So you're very much, it's not as intensive as oyster farming in the cages, but it's a much more intensive process than just sticking 50 boats on one reef and turning circles and, you know, destroying the ecosystem in the process. So, no, they're going to take care of it. They're actually going to be creating reefs because all of these are going in areas where there are no existing live oysters or where the number of live oysters is so small you wouldn't even call it a reef anymore. So they're going to be, in the process of this, rehabilitating, restoring those areas. So it's a win-win for the state.
Yeah, no, I love it. Before I let you get out of here, just a couple of little spitballing things. Our friends over in Louisiana get a deservedly, in my opinion, a bad rap for some of the bycatch, the boats, you know, with the Manhattan and such near shore. But there, you posted something on your page that I just found fascinating and very sad. But at least the person who posted it was a shrimper and was saying this is I hate this, you know, but. How bad or how much can we maybe, you know, handle the bycatch issues that we're facing around our bays?
Yeah, you know, with offshore shrimping, well, and I think bay shrimping too, you know, you get a tremendous amount of bycatch, you know, just to get a pound of shrimp, you know, bycatch can average, the amount of bycatch you get can average from 2 to 8 pounds. Sometimes it's even greater. So it's something that we've been concerned about for a long time. That's why we start, you know, we had the bay shrimp buyback program that's, you know, still ongoing, but just not as quite as intensive as it used to be. There's been bays that have been closed to shrimping at, designated as nursery areas. And so there's a lot of things that we've done because of the concern with buyback. But I just really appreciate it that as you pointed out, that shrimper just saying, hey man, it's not all easy. You know, sometimes we get all bycatch and this is an issue. And so you don't see that honesty a whole lot in shrimp in the shrimp fishery. And so I appreciated that, and I thought it was worth sharing because it is a concern and it's an issue that's ongoing. And we've done stuff in Texas by installing bycatch reduction devices on shrimp nets. And, you know, the fishery has improved, but again, it still has an impact.
This has been great, man. And we definitely will do it again. You know, we love having you on. We love what you guys do. Probably a good time since you're with CCA Texas to mention as well. Star Tournament, startournament.org. If you want to get in on that, that's always good. You know, this is the year for me. This is the year. I think it's year 27, something like that, that it has been my year.
you better get out on the water and get it done. There's some tags rolling in probably as we speak.
One of these days, Shane, one of these days. Appreciate it, man.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right, a lively hour one, and it's just getting better. More fishing discussion next, plus hunting season never ends. Real good one planned for you today. That's next right here on Sports Radio 610.